Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The state of Ohio will be the first to accept cryptocurrency for payment of taxes. State Treasurer Josh Mandel announced last week that with proper positioning, this move could attract talent and businesses as part of a larger movement toward the cryptocurrency in Ohio. Coindesk.com reporter Nolan Bowerly has been covering the issue. He joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Nolan.
Happy to be here.
What did you make of this when you heard about it?
Well, it was intriguing from the moment I heard about it, but when I scratched the surface and went a bit deeper, I thought that it was a really controlled environment, and there's still a lot of room to fulfill what he initially stated, what the treasurer initially stated, which is to take Bitcoin as payment of tax.
What do you mean?
What's going on is that they've created a service which is not so different than an exchange where they'll take cash, but give you cash at the time of paying your taxes, and that cash will be used to pay taxes. So what I think a lot of people would be truly revolutionary is if the state of Ohio kept Bitcoin on its own balance sheet and then accepted payments and didn't convert it so that you could actually pay your taxes in Bitcoin. Right now it's no different. I could do that today using an exchange. Bitcoin is extremely liquid, so it's not hard to get cash for Bitcoin. And then you can do whatever you want with it, pay taxes or, you know, buy a house. So what they've done here is interesting, a controlled environment. They're tentatively making steps to integrate this technology into the state's finances to make it easy. I do see it as potentially attracting people, but what would be truly revolutionary is if the treasurer actually put Bitcoin on the balance sheet and accepted Bitcoin for the payment of tax.
And what's the obstacles on that score?
I think they would have to live with a bit of the volatility. As we know, one of the great, you know, sort of use cases of Bitcoin so far has been speculation. People have made money and lost money. So it is uncorrelated to the rest of the market and moves up and down, and it is all based on price discovery. So everyone in the world all the time is sort of betting on the price of Bitcoin, and you have all these exchanges going up and down. So that is not the same thing, and I think that's what's keeping a lot of people tentative from putting it on the balance sheet, because you're living with that volatility. If you look at what's on the balance sheet of most states, you've got some real estate, you've got cash, of course. Central banks will hold some gold, they'll hold other fiat currencies from other countries. There still isn't a country that is taking Bitcoin yet on its balance sheet, but that's sort of one of the big next steps that a lot of people in the industry are really hoping to see.
Well, you said it'd be truly revolutionary, but would it be prudent for a state elected official, an elected state official who manages the state's money, to hold some of it in Bitcoin?
Probably not prudent at this time, just because of that volatility. Mm-hmm. But nevertheless, you could make out like a bandit if you did it. I mean, there still is a lot of things that are coming in the world of Bitcoin, a lot of infrastructure being built, a lot of utility being built. So there is an argument, and especially when you look at the policies of other central banks, that perhaps their quantitative easing and control of the money supply is starting to be stressed from what we've known for the past 100 years. Things are changing ever since, particularly the meltdown in America and what happened in Japan in the 1990s. Mm-hmm. So a lot of these, and then the euro, of course, all kinds of questions over there.
Right.
So there is potential to put it on your balance sheet. It wouldn't be imprudent to do it. You're taking it at value right now. The cost of Bitcoin is not so high. I don't think you'd be, risking the state's finances by doing it. And I do expect to see a major central bank, maybe not at the state level, but a major central bank internationally doing it within the next few years.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, where last week the state treasurer of Ohio, Josh Mandel, announced that Ohio would be the first state to accept cryptocurrency for payment of 23 different types of state taxes, business taxes, it should be noted, not everyday people's taxes. My guest is Nolan Bowerly. He's director of research at Coindesk.com, where they cover these sorts of things. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. What do you think, Nolan Bowerly, is the tipping point for a major central bank of some country to start to embrace Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency?
Well, I think you might see it with a country rebuilding in the short term. That might be the first. So imagine a situation where Venezuela has a change of government, and they're going to be pressed with all kinds of issues to reestablish the public infrastructure around governance in that country. And it might be appealing now that the Bolivar is essentially wiped away. I mean, they're just crossing zeros out daily on that currency. So it might be appealing for one of these to take a currency that's off the shelf. You know, here it is. You can just plug it into your economy and it can establish and behave as a kind of reserve, like a kind of gold reserve that countries used to build their wealth off of over 100 years ago. So that could be one of the things that actually tips. Otherwise, you might see an experimental, you know, taking a small amount onto a balance sheet. You've heard Christine Lagarde talk about it a bit. There is a possibility in America that it could happen. You know, in Washington itself, the head of the budget office for the White House, Mitch Mulvaney, his nickname is the Bitcoin Congressman. Before he was in the White House as just normal congressman, he was very interested in Bitcoin and saw it as sort of a return to sound money. Of course, not everyone is happy about all the money that was printed and all the quantitative easing that went on in America after the meltdown. Mm-hmm. So there is an appetite internationally. Japan is another example. They seem to be quite addicted to quantitative easing, and we see Bitcoin's acceptance and Bitcoin's traction in Japan is probably the highest because they know what happens to their money every single year. I remember going to Japan 20 years ago, and then I was again there this year. Everything is the same price. It was expensive 20 years ago. Now, all of a sudden, the country is quite cheap for a visitor. And, you know, you'll hear people say, well, it's expensive for us to go to America now, and it really wasn't back in the 1990s and 2000s. And a lot of this has to do with this power that the central bank has wielded.
What about a place like England and Brexit and that sort of thing? Is there an opportunity there?
I think so. So when the Brexit vote first happened, the story that we covered at CoinDesk was that the price of Bitcoin actually bumped because people were using it as a hedge against the uncertainty that surrounded both the euro and the pound at the time. So it was at the end of the year, we said, one of the big stories of the year. We saw it again in India in 2017 when they demonetized. When India demonetized, or maybe it was the end of 2016, pardon me. When India demonetized, they basically said, we have no more, you know, they call it the full faith and credit. The full faith and credit that the American government has in the U.S. dollar or that the Indian government has in the rupee. And they said, we've actually lost full faith and in this money. Some of this money is becoming too easy to be counterfeited. So what happened then is they got rid of a certain amount of the physical money supply. So they just erased, you know, imagine if they erased like 50% of the $50 bills in America. And they said, okay, these are all no good any longer. And there was a buyback period where they inspected the dollars and all that. But what ended up happening was the price of Bitcoin shot up in India. All of a sudden, you had people who said, well, I want this safe harbor. So, yes, a similar thing could happen in Brexit when we see all of these storm clouds and that Bitcoin is uncorrelated to the decisions of any of these central banks and any of these political entities. It doesn't care and doesn't know what's going on with them. It's still just a price discovery going on around the world. And because of that, it's insulated from these decisions, which is what a lot of people find attractive.
In more developing countries where the digital economy has taken off without the brick and mortar, is that an opportunity?
Yeah, take a look at Colorado or even Canada. So with a lot of the marijuana legislation that's come in and the legalization, yeah, particularly of commercial marijuana, these people have become unbanked, not so different than people from the developing world. What I mean by that is, even though marijuana became legal, you've got the lobby group in Colorado, for example. So all they want to do is set laws for smoking and driving. And I mean, they're not out there trying to promote marijuana to anyone. That's not their point. There really is just to get fair legislation. And a lot of it is legislation that would sort of protect people, like smoking and driving laws. They're very pro that. But they got debanked. The banks said, okay, well, we can't take you on as a risk. So you've got all these companies that have been de-risked. We have our entire banking system that has been deputized by regulators to weed out terrorism financing and money laundering. Mm-hmm. And they've taken important steps to doing this. But they've taken on really a policing role. And because they have penalties for banking anyone who does perform money laundering, they basically just want to get rid of all these customers. I'm sure they would love all the cash of a lot of these marijuana businesses.
Yeah.
Not against the drug, I don't think. But what they're basically saying is, we're too afraid. We face legal responsibilities for banking you. So just go away and we can't help you. So you've got all these people with cash. And now you've got this new payment system. So there is an opportunity, particularly there, I see, as this technology could sweep in and actually help protect some of these businesses. Because I've heard some violent stories of this cash getting robbed. You know, there's a lot of cash for people that don't, you know, they're trying to run a small business.
Well, and these businesses seem primed to be the ones that could avail themselves of paying their state taxes by way of cryptocurrency.
I think absolutely they could. That is one that is a great example.
Well, that's really interesting. I mean, that's a damned if you do and damned if you don't kind of position for the banks to be in, right?
Yeah, I think we're going to have to look at it in general again, because you don't actually see a lot of prosecutions coming from the Bank Secrecy Act. That's what it's called. That's what gives FinCEN all of these powers. And it was, I think, an uneasy burden. I don't think they were happy that they had been deputized in this way. And we see a lot of collection of data and a lot of collection of information. We don't see a lot of prosecutions. There's not a lot of people being prosecuted under the Bank Secrecy Act for money laundering or terrorism financing, but it's still going on, of course.
Mm-hmm.
We all know what's going on. People are definitely laundering money. But they're not catching them with the regime that's out there already. But these are enormous burdens for banks. You know, it's not so bad for Bank of America, but, you know, you've got small banks in Ohio. Not every bank can afford all this reporting apparatus that's been forced on them, the mm-hmm. type of compliance that's been asked of them, really pierces their role and makes them into a type of law enforcement agency. You know, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but nevertheless, they're heavily relied upon by a lot of these, a lot of these organizations looking to weed out criminality. And I think it's an uneasy relationship, and it might not last. So because this technology, even if you look at the GDPR, this new privacy regulation that came in throughout Europe, so the GDPR, you know, gives a lot of more responsibilities to companies like Google, almost another deputization of security for people's personal information. So whenever you're sharing personal information, you know, there's a huge responsibility, much like for banks, that's been placed on a lot of other service providers online. And these can be Amazon or Google or anyone else taking your personal information. Because anything on the internet now using this personal information is to authenticate. You know, you've got to know your mother's name, your dog's name, your
right.
mother-in-law's name.
I can't always forget those questions, too.
Yeah, it doesn't end, right? So, but they put it a pretty interesting exclusion in the GDPR. And what it was if you keep your keys with you, so if the user doesn't have to share an overly large amount of personal information, they can share it and store it somewhere. But nevertheless, if they're expressing consent with a cryptographic key, which is what Bitcoin is, there is no money, right? It's just cryptographic keys. You're sharing these cryptographic keys.
Mm-hmm.
The same thing, the same key you get from a bank, the same cryptographic key you get for your bank when you do your login is what Bitcoin is. You just have it in your hand, right? You don't have to share all this information. So
mm-hmm.
that changes it from being a push transaction right, like cash, like I just put it on the counter and I walk away and it doesn't matter, to a pull transaction where it's pulled out of your account, which is what every credit card or debit card is. They're pulling the money out of your account. So this push transaction, according to the GDPR in Europe, they said, okay, they didn't mean to exclude Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies, but they did. They said, if you do it this way, it's called privacy by design. If you design privacy at the engineering level, then you're excluded from this law. So, because it's sound security, right? If you have the key, you're fine. So this preference of an architecture, this preference of the way security is orchestrated, is really what a lot of the speculation behind Bitcoin, not all of it, but a major amount of it, is that we're going to be expressing consent generally using these cryptographic keys that don't require us to, mention our dog's name and our old dog's name after school and all that stuff.
Well, just before I let you go, what is the value of a Bitcoin today?
I think today we're around $4,000. I didn't check yet this morning, but yeah, it's been really on the downswing for the past few days and the past month and a bit. So definitely in the crosshairs of some important people who don't believe in the price right now.
Nolan Bowerly, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me.
Nolan Bowerly is Director of Research at Coindesk.com. We've been talking about plans announced last week by the state treasurer to accept cryptocurrency, that is, in this case, Bitcoin, for payment of 23 taxes and possibly more down the road. More Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Congress has until December 10th to overturn the repeal of net neutrality rules. House Democrats are working to get 218 signatures to force a vote on a resolution. Whether they succeed is unclear. Motherboard reporter Kaylee Rogers has been covering the issue. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show, Kaylee.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So give us that quick thumbnail on net neutrality and how we got here.
Right. So net neutrality is the principle, and up until past December, it was the federal law that made it so that internet service providers could not choose what kind of content you could access. So most of the time, they don't want to do this, but it prevents things from happening, like if an ISP happens to own a video streaming service, it stops them from being able to, say, slow down Netflix so that you don't like Netflix anymore and you want to use their service instead. That is now legal because they got rid of the net neutrality protections last December under the FCC.
Has it gone into effect?
Yeah, so it went into effect in June. There hasn't been any major changes yet, but to be honest, I think the ISPs would probably be playing it cool right now because there is still so much back and forth over whether it's going to stick.
Why the December 10th deadline? Is that a function of what a discharge petition is?
It's a function of just the end of the year. So
okay.
Because it was introduced this year, that's what the ending when they can do it. So if it fails to meet that deadline, then they'll have to start from scratch again next year.
So far, the Democrats pushing for the discharge petition have 177 signers. They need 41 more. You wrote about the influence of telecom money in this.
I did, yeah. So actually, they're up to 178 now.
Okay.
Representative Morelli actually signed shortly after I called him and asked if he was going to sign. So that happened. If you take a look at the Democrats who haven't signed this petition, which really would just give them the chance to vote on this issue in the House, it wouldn't, it wouldn't guarantee anything, but it would bring it to a vote. The ones who haven't signed the petition have all received funding from big telecoms during campaigns. Whether or not that means, they have any kind of agreement is to be seen. But I thought it was worth noting because these telecoms have a lot of influence. They have a lot of money and a big lobbying power in Washington. And the fact that these Democrats haven't signed on to something that is pretty well supported among their base is really interesting.
What's the philosophical difference between Republicans and Democrats on the issue of net neutrality?
It's just more common for Republicans to be against the government's influence on this. They're worried that it could, you know, too much regulation could limit the market and prevent businesses from being able to function the way they want to, which is, you know, sort of classic Republican point of view. But the thing is, it's really interesting. The public across, you know, Republican and Democratic voters, the majority support net neutrality, regardless of their political leanings. So it's interesting that anyone would be kind of against it as a politician when their voters are very much for it.
You know, and even the phrase net neutrality suggests more of a free market.
Absolutely. And studies have shown that it's actually better for smaller competitors trying to get into the market. If you have an ISP that has a lot of control over what its users are seeing and accessing, that's going to make it harder for a new startup business to get in and compete.
What about states such as California that are passing their own version of net neutrality?
Well, it's interesting. I know that the telecom industry does not want this sort of cobbled together approach.
In fact,
just having the federal regulation would be a lot easier because obviously, you know, they're providing to across state lines or providing to different areas. So that's kind of their worst nightmare.
California is one of their biggest markets.
For sure, yeah. And California has passed something already. They have probably the most ambitious net neutrality law. It even goes beyond what the federal levels were. There's some questions as to whether the FCC might try and crack down on those state laws and say that it's not up to the states to decide this. So everything is still very much in contention.
You said it goes beyond federal levels. How so?
It was just very firm in its language, and it covers things that maybe weren't explicitly covered with the original federal language.
It took a long time to get to the net neutrality that existed before the FCC changed this earlier this year. What took so long, and why was the FCC able to change it so quickly?
Yeah, it's interesting because it did take several years, and the commissioners on the FCC previously under the Obama administration all worked together, and they were, you know, skeptical. They weren't just gung-ho to introduce these laws. They really talked to the industry. They talked to voters. They did a lot of consulting to come up with rules that they thought were fair and made sense with how we use the internet today. And then it was just sort of one swift vote under the new FCC this past December that changed it because it's appointed by the president, and now we have more of a Republican majority on the FCC. They just, you know, they were outnumbered, and so they were able to change that pretty quickly.
Does the makeup, the change with Democrats regaining control of the House, does that change any of the equation in Washington right now?
Not right now, only because this is something that was introduced this year, so we're still looking at it from the view of the 2018 House. So even if, you know, all of these Democratic representatives who haven't yet signed the petition did sign on, we would still need a handful of Republican representatives to sign on as well in order for the petition to actually go through.
Well, is there any chance of that?
I would say it's very slim.
Yeah.
I know that individuals that are really passionate about this are trying to put pressure. They're doing phone calls, you know, they're reaching out to representatives, they're crowdfunding billboards to sort of shame politicians in their local districts. You know, this politician took so much money from Comcast and also didn't sign the petition. So they're doing everything they can to try and raise awareness and put a little more pressure on. But I think just with the deadline creeping up and the number of names that would still be required, it would be surprising if they can pull it off.
Mm-hmm. But when they take control next session, I guess I'm trying to get a fix on how the current deadline is. It's a legislative deadline issue. Can Congress revisit this whenever?
No. So what happened is under the CRA, the Congressional Review Act, Congress had 60 days from the time that the rules actually were published by the FCC to challenge it. And they did that in the Senate, and that challenge passed the Senate. This is now in the House, but isn't being considered for a vote because no one's interested in it. So this is what that petition would do. It would force it to come to a vote.
And they can't do it again next session.
No, because those rules would have been past the 60-day deadline.
So are there any particular potential signers of note that are on the fence that people are talking about?
Actually, no. You know, a lot of the folks that haven't signed yet, it's surprising because they have previously come out in favor of net neutrality. Mm-hmm. And I mean, having an ISP contribute to your campaign is not unusual. A lot of folks that have signed also.
They have a lot of other issues out there, yeah.
Yeah, it's not unusual, and it doesn't preclude one from signing this petition or being in favor of net neutrality.
All right, so it was wise of the providers then to hold back and not make any big changes while this was all happening. So apparently the interest nationally among everyday people has lessened a lot, hasn't it?
I think it started to wane, especially now that the midterms are over, so there's less sort of impact that it can have on saying, you know, you didn't vote for net neutrality, so I'm not voting for you. There's definitely those that are very passionate about it that are still getting out there. And to be honest, it's going to continue to be up in the air. There are lawsuits that are in play right now. As you mentioned, there are state-level rules being put into place. It's possible that Congress could pass its own net neutrality rule regulations, which is sort of the best-case scenario, because then that would allow everybody to sort of have input, and it would be actually put in law rather than under the FCC being able
and
to go back and forth.
Right. It would void the FCC then?
It would have its own regulation, so it wouldn't be under the FCC necessarily.
Is that what would change, is it would take the onus or the OSP, take it out from underneath the FCC?
Possibly. I mean, having it completely up to the FCC is difficult because, as we see, you know, it's changing every few years,
right,
whether it's more right-leaning or more left-leaning. And as we saw, it's pretty easy to just sort of scrap and go back to previous decisions, even after a lot of work and effort goes into making new rules.
Even if they achieve this, even if they get the 200 signatures they need, that still needs to be signed. And if it's approved at all, it still needs to be signed by President Trump, right?
Absolutely. So this would be a big, big reach. Not only would they need enough signatures to bring it to a vote, but then it would have to pass the House. And then, of course, it would have to be signed by President Trump. It's his FCC that repealed the original rule. So I can't imagine that he would want to go against them, but, you know, it's hard to say with President Trump.
I was surprised, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you said that it did pass the Senate.
It did, yes, and it was tight. They needed a simple majority to pass the Senate, and they got that. There was a couple Republicans who had expressed discomfort with the FCC's decision and wanted to go back on it, and so they were able to get that support.
Is this still at a point now where if people want, they could call their you know, member of Congress and say, I want you to do this or that over it? Is it something that everyday people could weigh in on?
Absolutely, yeah. So, and especially if your representative is on that list and is a Democrat who's ostensibly supposed to be for net neutrality and also has taken money from ISPs and also hasn't signed this petition, I think it never hurts to put a little pressure on them and let them know what their constituents think of that.
Anyone in Ohio?
Sorry?
Anyone in Ohio?
Oh, let me look at my list. Let's see here.
Check it twice.
Yes, definitely. Oh, I think Ohio's covered. You guys are good.
Okay. Well, unless you oppose net neutrality, and then give them a call. But in the meantime, Kaylee Rogers, thanks so much for your help today.
Thank you so much.
That's Kaylee Rogers. She is a staff writer for Motherboard. She's been covering the issue of net neutrality. House Democrats are working to get 218 signatures to force a vote on a resolution to repeal net neutrality rules put forth by the FCC. We have more Tech Tuesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Android Central contributing editor Russell Holly puts together a gift guide for Tech Tuesday listeners every year. We discussed some ideas for young children last week. You can check that out online at WOSU.org/allsides. Today we're talking about ideas for teens, the easiest people on your Christmas list, I'm sure. Russell Holly joins us now. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
All right, buying toys and other gifts for teenagers, I was just kidding, it can be very tricky. What in general, with your vast experience with teenagers, what makes a good tech gift?
The biggest thing right now is portability. A lot of the gifts that were given in previous years, when it's, you know, a kind of a bigger tech gift, like a phone or a tablet or something like that, it's become kind of more the focus this year that thing be just as portable as possible to, you know, and as useful as possible. In some cases, it ends up being the only computer or the only kind of main gadget for that person.
Yeah, portability is defined how?
You know, it's a combination of battery life and kind of availability, right? So, you know, it's not enough that it be light, but it also needs to be something that can charge quickly. It's something that can have a battery that'll last an extended period of time. It's something that, in many cases, has the ability to rapidly connect to a cellular network if necessary. You know, the idea is for it to be something that you can use in as many places as possible without needing to carry a bunch of extra things with you.
Mm. All right. And you wanted to talk about the Nokia 7.1 smartphone. Tell us about it. And if I mispronounce anything, as usual, correct me.
No, that was great. And it's so weird to be in 2018 and talking about a Nokia phone again. Not something that I thought I would be doing at the beginning of the year. It's pretty exciting. Nokia made a couple of phones, or rather the company that owns the Nokia brand, made a couple of phones this year running Android. And this one, the Nokia 7.1, is this really great kind of middle ground. It's not particularly expensive. It's not it's not kind of crammed with unnecessary features. It is a really great middle ground phone that is a fantastic kind of first phone for teenagers, where it, you know, has a pretty decent camera, has a really great battery. It's running a version of Android that is constantly getting the latest software and security updates. So it's just kind of an all-around phone that we recommend both as a budget option and as kind of that first phone for people.
And, you know, maybe 15 or 20 years ago, you would never have said that $350 is the budget option, but that's what it costs, right?
Yeah, I mean, when you're looking at phones that are, you know, the top of the line iPhone starts at, or doesn't start at, but the top of the line iPhone is almost $1,300. You know, you're shaving $1,000 off for someone's first phone. That's pretty incredible. And again, you know, we kind of live in a world now where attaching things to contracts is not really the way that we do things in a lot of places. So if you're looking at buying a phone that can be used on multiple networks, if you're looking at a phone that you can attach to maybe a really inexpensive cellular plan through either, you know, Mint SIM or Cricket or something like that, this is one of the options that's available to you.
Well, how have they been able to keep it so cheap, or less expensive, I should say, and still make it what you think of as a good value and a good smartphone value?
A lot of this has to do with Nokia just working really, really closely with Google to make sure that the software is not an expense that that this company really needs to worry about. So the focus can be on getting the parts as inexpensively as possible and not worrying about things like whether it's glass on both sides or whether there's wireless charging or whether the camera is the absolute best camera that you can buy and is instead just a pretty good camera. And you know, kind of scaling back on some of those things that we consider kind of premium things now really kind of all rolls together into this really kind of baseline experience.
And what are some of the drawbacks then of that baseline experience?
Well, you don't get things like wireless charging. Cases for this phone are going to be a little varied. There's not going to be, you know, you're not going to be able to walk into Best Buy and find 50 different cases for it. So you're going to be kind of limited. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they do still exist. Like I said, the camera is not the, you know, the absolute best camera that you can buy, but it takes pretty good pictures in everything but really low light situations. And the phone is really something that would last a little while. Like if you're going to get a couple of years out of it without a problem.
Is this the start of something? Are we going to see more and more of these more affordable lines for people that either don't really care about having the latest, or particularly for you know, that first phone?
What's interesting is that this is, you know, this is something that's been happening for about 2 years now. This is something that Motorola actually started a couple years ago with what was called the Moto G line.
Oh, yeah.
And the Moto G was the phone that we recommended for the last year and actually the year before that. And it's one of these phones that is seen as kind of this budget starter phone here in the U.S. But in Argentina, for example, it is like the premier flagship phone. Like you go to Argentina, this is the phone that everyone has. Is the Moto G and the Moto E Plus. And so the Nokia 7.1 is actually made to compete in those places, to compete in markets like Argentina, where importing from other countries is you know, prohibitively expensive. So putting those phones there, you know, actually makes them kind of this high-end phone because it's so easy to get a hold of. And that, that you know, translates here to the U.S. as this kind of starter phone because that's the price point that they're aiming for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really kind of both. You know, this is both a new trend that something that more companies are seeing the value of, mm-hmm. but it's something that has actually been done around the world for a couple of years now.
Yeah, I mean, the Moto commercials come to mind. I mean, they pushed them pretty hard.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Nintendo Switch. Let's talk about it. We've talked about it before. It's been out for a while, but it's always popular around the holiday season. First, for people who don't know, tell us, what is the Nintendo Switch?
So this is the game console that Nintendo made after the Wii U failed to launch. It didn't do as well as the Nintendo Wii before it. There was actually a lot of people who didn't know that there was a difference between the Nintendo Wii and the Nintendo Wii U, which is kind of a bad marketing thing that Nintendo had to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of making this a console that was, you know, television first and then had some extra things on it like the Wii U did, this is actually a game console that is designed first to be held in your hand entirely. The entire console fits in the palm of your hand and you can play anywhere. You can actually detach the controllers from the sides of the console and play multiplayer with another person out of the box. It's the only game console that by design comes with two controllers so that multiplayer is something that you can do the moment that you buy it. And when you get to another place, you get to a place with a big television, you can actually dock this console into that thing. And everything that you were doing in that handheld mode is now on your high-definition television for you to play with as many other people as you want. It allows for, there are some games that allow for up to 16 people to play at the same time through this console. It is the most portable game console that has really kind of ever been designed with this in mind. And it's, you know, it's been out for 2 years now and it is still, you know, by far the most popular game console that is sold just about every month of the year.
And, you know, portable being a key word there, right?
It's incredibly portable. It's you know, it's designed to be, you know, kind of carried around. The only caveat there is that you, if you find yourself playing for multiple hours in a day, you really do want to bring kind of a battery with you to charge it because the battery itself only lasts 3 to 4 hours. But you know, outside of that, it really is, you know, kind of the best of both worlds for game consoles.
Is there anything new about the Nintendo Switch?
The biggest thing that's new is just a huge collection of video games. The collection of games that you can get for under $20 online is just massive that you can get through the Nintendo eShop. Nintendo has worked really hard this year to make sure that the games that are available for it are incredibly high quality. And by the end of this week, there's actually a brand new game coming out for it that is going to really make a big deal over the holidays. It's Super Smash Brothers Ultimate. The Smash series has been one of the biggest titles in Nintendo's history because it takes games from every single Nintendo title and puts them all in one place so that they can all fight one another.
Ergo the Smash, right?
Right. Yeah. So it ends up being just a tremendous amount of fun. There are entire nationally or globally ranked tournaments built around this game. For people who play all around the world, and it has, in every console that it has been released for over the past 15 years, has been just tremendously successful.
So is that the must-have? If you're going to go and get somebody a Switch, get them the Smash.
Smash Ultimate is definitely something that should come with it if you're getting one for this Christmas season, yeah.
What about accessories?
The biggest thing for accessories is deciding. It really just kind of depends on the gameplay. I'm always a big fan of having a separate carrying case with it because you know the display is glass, and while it is built pretty sturdy, you know, drops are just a thing that happens. So a solid carrying case is always a good idea. Battery backups are always a good idea, and it really also depends on what kind of gameplay you plan on doing as to how many controllers you want to bring with you. If you find yourself playing with a lot of different people, then having another set of those controllers in your bag when you travel makes a huge difference.
Parental controls?
Parental controls are not only built into the console, but have a separate wireless connection to an app that you maintain on your phone. So I can actually set a PIN number for the Switch on my phone and from my phone say, today's a Friday, my kids had, today's a Monday, my kids have school today, they're only allowed to play for half an hour. And so when that half an hour reaches, the Nintendo Switch just shuts off and says, you know, you've reached your limit for today. Unless you enter in a PIN number, you're not allowed to play anymore. And so there's a ton of different content and timing controls like that that are not only available, but you as the parent don't actually even have to touch the Switch in order to make them work.
Huh. All the stuff that you have to set up, is it a lot, or is it that portability makes it so it can all fit in one bag?
Setup is pretty easy. You can fit everything in one bag. And, you know, a lot of this is done through the use of kind of physical cartridges that you snap into the case or just entirely purchased online. It's up to you as the user. I'm still personally a fan of the little cartridges, although they are kind of the same size as like a camera SD card, like a storage card for a camera,
yeah.
Which means they can be pretty easily lost.
Uh-huh.
Although weird side note, Nintendo actually patented a process by which those cards are coated in a special material that is bitter if you put the card in your mouth to stop kids from eating them.
Oh, well, see, they thought of everything, right?
That's, yeah.
Gosh.
Please, I said it, and if the listeners don't believe me, I just please don't put it in your mouth. Yeah. It is the grossest thing.
Wow, that must have been a real issue.
Yeah, they really wanted people to not eat these, and they had, you know, and so the material. Obviously, when they announced this, I was like, "Well, I have to know." So I did it for you,
a man after my own heart. Yeah, I'd do the same thing if I was in your position. Okay, so lest I forget, how much?
You can get most kind of starter kits for this at around $300. There are some kits that you can get that are a little more that come with an extra game and some extra controllers, depending on where you go to buy. And the biggest thing there, if you're not sure about the price, is to compare the individual prices online before you make that purchase, just in case a retailer has, kind of stuffed some accessories in there that aren't maybe, the highest quality, so mm-hmm. that you know exactly what it is that you're buying. But you're looking at starting at around $300.
$300 for the Switch, and then you have to get a game for it.
Yeah, there are some cases where a game comes with it, and like, yeah. I said, this is one of those consoles where, you know, you get like an Xbox, the top of the line Xbox game is like $70. So you're spending almost another $100 for one game that comes with it. There are just an enormous amount of games in the Nintendo Switch eStore that are under $20 and are really good. You're not spending nearly as much per game most of the time.
Okay. Let's see. Is it Anki?
Anki, yeah.
Anki. A lot of people know it as the company that made a smart race car. Anki released a little robot called Vector. It's not their first robot, though, right?
This is not. The first robot was called Cosmo, and Cosmo needed your phone in order to work. But when it did, it was this little like desktop robot that could roll around, and it had a little camera in the front that it could detect your face and talk to you and play a bunch of games. And it was a very cute little thing that was very limited in its functionality. And the idea was to take that design and just make it a whole lot smarter in this next generation. And Vector is the product of this next generation.
And did they achieve their goal?
They absolutely did. This doesn't require a phone to do anything other than the initial setup. It connects to Wi-Fi. And responds to voice commands. You say, "Hey, Vector," and it wakes up just like your, you know, Google Assistant or Amazon Echo or anything like that. It'll wake up and start listening to you. You can tell it to patrol your desk. You can tell it to, you can have it recognize, I think, up to 15 different people's faces, so that when another person walks in the room, it just recognizes them and says their name and talks to them, which is kind of a cute party trick, unless someone is afraid of robots. And then, it's a different kind of fun. You roll the dice coming into my house, is all I'm saying. There's a lot of different things that you can do, just kind of basic voice commands. But a very big update in the last month added the Amazon Echo service to it. So you can actually use that Amazon A word, and it wakes up and acts exactly like an Amazon Echo to do things like check the weather and play music and do things like that, which is really kind of functional on top of this kind of cute thing.
Is Vector with us now?
Vector is not with us now. Vector is in the other room because Vector likes to hear my voice and then wake up and start making noise. it ended up being a problem.
So what does Vector's voice sound like?
It's very robotic. It's very almost like cartoon robotic. You hear it and it sounds like something you've seen on a TV show.
It isn't cheap. It's $250.
They're $250, although I will say, even though it's been out for a couple of weeks already, there have been several sales that have dropped it below $200.
Mm-hmm.
So if you shop around, you probably won't end up spending the $250 for it.
Okay. But why is it so expensive? What does it do? Can you tell it to do anything? Can it clean up your room?
No, it is small. This is a robot that fits in the palm of your hand. It doesn't really leave your desk or leave your end table or anything like that. This is very much a toy. This is a toy that does some smart things that are pretty cool. And in a house like mine, where you've got smart lighting and things like that, you can also use this toy to do things like control your lights and your door locks and things like that. But all of that, assumes that you have spent a lot more money on other smart gadgets. On its own, this really is just kind of an expensive toy, and sometimes that's okay.
Because it's a toy. It's a gift. It's for fun, right? Right, okay. Are there going to be more of these kind of robot toys out there? Do you see a market for it?
I definitely see there being more space for this as we move into things like Google Assistant and Amazon Echo becoming more a part of people's homes and lives, is things that have that kind of base functionality with this other kind of fun stuff added in.
You wanted to talk about the iPad Pro versus the Surface Go, which you should buy. First, give us that thumbnail on both and tell us, which is which and why.
Yeah, so both of these came out this year, Microsoft with the Surface Go and Apple with the iPad Pro 11. And both of these are very, very similar in size. They're very similar in shape. And the design is the same for these to be just very, very portable computers that you can take with you. They weigh less than a pound. The keyboards that attach to them are very, very small. They have pens that you can use for writing things. They are functionally very similar machines. Depending on which model you get, there is almost a $400 difference in price between the two of them.
Mm-hmm.
The iPad Pro starts at a very expensive $799, and the keyboard that you get on it is not cheap either. And the pen that you get for it is another expense that you get for it. Whereas the Surface Go model you can get starts at almost $350, if memory serves, for kind of the base model that you would get for that machine. I'm sorry, $400.
Mm-hmm.
And then again, you still have to buy a keyboard to go with it. And if you wanted the pen would go with it. But it's considerably less expensive to go this route. And honestly, the Surface Go is the one that I end up recommending to a lot of people because you get a full version of Windows. There are simply more that can be done on the Surface Go than the iPad, and you get a lot more flexibility as far as places that you are comfortable typing. The iPad keyboard fixes you in one very specific position where you have to sit in a very specific way in order for it to be comfortable to type.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't get things like a trackpad or anything like that with the iPad because the Apple software isn't really built for that. Whereas the Microsoft tablet gives you a very good kind of laptop experience in this very flexible form. I think the way that I end up putting it most times is if you want a really good tablet that is an okay laptop some of the time, the iPad is good, but it's kind of expensive. And if you want a laptop that is a really good laptop, but an okay tablet some of the time, then the Surface Go is where you want to go.
Russell Holly, thank you so much, as always.
Thank you for having me.
Next week, it's your gift guide for old people.
Well, I certainly didn't put it that way, but now that you have, yes.
All right, Russell. Thank you so much. That's Russell Holly, Android Central Contributing Editor. And that's it for Tech Tuesday today. So thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.